Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, I was seriously thinking about hiding the receiver when the switch broke, because it's old. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Hochelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today...
Yes, Joe?
We're going to be talking about radar.
Yay!
Right. And just for our fans who are my age or older, we're not talking about the popular character from the movie and television series MASH.
Unfortunately not.
No. We're talking about the actual technology radar.
Which is nothing new.
No, it's been around for quite a few decades, but it's super cool. There are a lot of different applications for it that are really interesting.
And apparently there are going to be some new applications for it in the future.
Yeah, and even...
If there is a future.
Well, it's on my radar.
Well,
it's going to happen. I might as well get it out of the way early. The neat thing is the way that the technology is changing over time. Like, it's being married with other technologies, but we'll get into that.
Okay, well, let me explore the layman's view of radar.
Okay.
What is radar, if you don't know? It has something to do with a circular screen that has a line that sweeps around it,
right,
and goes bloop, bloop.
Oh, you've bloop. Mistaken it for sonar.
Oh, no, wait, yeah. hold on. It has something to do with like a little antenna that spins around really fast.
Yeah, that's closer. And there can be around screen. It's just the bloop is totally indicative of sonar as opposed to radar.
You could make a radar display bloop. Why
you
not?
Could,
you make
but
anything
then,
you want bloop. That is the true incredible future.
Blooping is one of the easiest things to program.
Look, I've studied screenplays, and I realize that if you make it bloop, you have confused your audience. So, but no, the other interesting thing that we want to talk about before we actually get into what radar is and how it works is the fact that it used to be an acronym, and now it's not anymore.
It's one of those words like laser. Laser was like this, wasn't it?
Yep, it sure was.
Yeah, so it used to stand for something, and now it doesn't stand for anything.
Radar won't stand. You could walk into it. The president of the United States could walk into a room. Radar's not going to get up.
Right. It's just like it's just a lowercase word. You don't even capitalize it. But what did it originally stand for?
Radio detection and ranging. That's what the United States Navy referred to it as.
And the RA of radio were capitalized because it wasn't in the day when they would just add extra random words in there in order to make the really cool.
Yeah, they didn't want to call it ERDAR.
Yeah.
Right.
So
ERDAR.
Turn on the ERDAR.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, that did not fly, so they went with radar.
But today, it's just radar.
Yeah,
it's just the little lowercase word radar because we say it so much, you know.
Yeah, I mean, boy, if I had a nickel for every time I talked about radar in your average week.
Well, let's explain how radar actually works.
Sure.
It's actually a pretty simple principle.
Yeah, it's actually very similar to echolocation. Right. It's based on a very and in fact, sonar, it's based on similar principles, except instead of sound, we're talking about radio waves, which, by the way, don't work so well underwater, but they work great above water. So essentially what you're doing is you're sending out bursts of radio waves or microwaves. Like, we're talking super short bursts, like microsecond long bursts. And you do that off in whatever direction you're looking at. And if those waves encounter an object, some of them will bounce back toward the source of the transmission. So you've got a transmitter and a receiver. You turn on the transmitter, you send out a blast of radio waves, you switch off the transmitter, you turn on the receiver. And when those returning waves come back, one, you know that there's an object out there that the waves have encountered. And two, you know how far away it is because you can measure the time it took from when the radio waves went out of the antenna to when the echo came back in. And beyond that, you can actually tell whether or not the object is moving toward you or away from you using the Doppler shift.
Right, the Doppler effect that we're all familiar with from hearing police sirens, right?
Yeah.
When you hear a police siren approaching you, it's getting this high pitch noise,
right,
and it gets higher and higher. And then after it passes you, you know that
it suddenly gets lower.
Right. And the reason it does that, the Doppler effect applies to all waves. It's not just sound waves. It's also radio waves. And what's happening is essentially those waves are being compressed ahead of the moving object when it's coming toward you. So the frequency is increased. And when the frequency increases with sound, that means the pitch goes up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when the object passes by you, then the waves are being elongated. So now the pitch has decreased. It's gone down. And if you were standing right next to the to a stationary police vehicle while it was having the siren go off, it would sound in between those two. Well, relatively speaking.
Yeah, and in fact, you can even observe this with visible light. Say, like in astronomy, the distant
Redshift
objects,
and blue shift.
Yeah, moving away from us faster and faster in the galaxy or in the universe are going to be redshifted.
Right, and in fact, also this is really part of what sonic booms, you know, why we have a sonic boom. If you have an object that's moving faster than the speed of sound at whatever altitude you happen to be at, because sound speed depends upon the medium it's traveling through, and with atmosphere, it could be affected by lots of stuff like humidity, the air density, the temperature, all that kind of thing. But anyway, if we're talking about something moving faster than the speed of sound, all of those sound waves get compressed so flat that if you're in front of that object and it's coming toward you, you're not going to hear anything. You might say, "What's that?" before it gets past you. And once it gets past you, then essentially all that sound is unleashed in a
it catches up.
Yeah, a glorious boom of fury. And that's where the sonic boom comes in. And actually the sonic boom rolls along as long as the object continues to move faster than the speed of sound. Now with radio waves, we don't get the sonic boom because we're talking about radio frequencies. We're not talking about acoustic waves. But what we can see is that if the frequency of the returning echo is greater than that than the frequency we sent out, then we know the object that we're looking at is moving toward us. If the frequency is less than what we sent out, we know the object is moving away from us.
Mm-hmm. And by sending out series of these signals, we can tell in what direction and at what speed the object is moving.
Exactly. And because each of these bursts is like a microsecond in length, you can do this several times a minute, you know, depending upon what your system is looking for and how you're focusing on that particular section of sky usually.
Yeah. And so if I remember correctly, you'll probably be able to tell me, mostly radar is going to be operating in the microwave frequency of the EM spectrum,
right? That's largely what we see today. A lot of radio radar works in the microwaves, but it can work in other parts of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think originally a lot of it was in radio.
Yeah.
Right. So that would be
microwaves.
So if you imagine the EM spectrum, like you've got the longer wavelengths than visible light or microwaves, and then the even longer than that are what we usually call radio waves.
Right. So and the frequency would be, you know, the greater the frequency, the greater the amount of information we can get back, which is why you want to use higher frequencies if you can, but we'll get into that later.
Which is part of why we talked so much about microwaves in another episode.
Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. If you can get more information from higher frequency, why don't we just use gamma rays?
Well, there are a lot of reasons why. One is that we don't want a lot of Incredible Hulks running around.
Says you.
Yeah. Well, honestly, obviously gamma radiation would be incredibly dangerous, even if we could generate it easily without pouring tons of energy into whatever system we had created to make gamma radiation.
That was my guess, is just that it's harder to make gamma rays.
And that it would also kill you, yeah. The two combined are really good reasons why we don't go into it.
Okay, well, let's look back at the sort of the early days of radar, the juvenilia of radar.
Well, back when radar was just a gleam in a bunch of engineers' eyes, you got to look at the beginning of the 20th century. So a lot of the groundwork was laid in the 19th century, where you had people discovering and experimenting with radio waves. But it wasn't until the early 20th century that we started seeing people figure out, oh, we might be able to use this in order to detect things. There was an engineer named Christian Hülsmeyer who invented a system that allowed ships or trains to avoid collisions on foggy days. The source I was reading, which was the APS Physics website, referred to it as crude. In other words, it was not a very refined system.
Sure, but you can immediately see or not see, as the case may be, mm-hmm. the benefit that radio waves have over electromagnetic light waves. Well, sorry, visible spectrum
sure.
light waves.
Yeah.
On a foggy day, because
right.
you can't see through fog.
Right, yeah. You have,
but radio waves could bounce right through.
If light is going to be reflected off the fog bank ahead of you, it doesn't. You can't really count on that being an effective signal to any other vehicles. So, yeah, it was certainly something that was useful. The U.S. Navy had begun to experiment with radar, although it wasn't called that at the time, to search for ships, but actually, that research was largely overlooked in the United States. Like, it was a group of researchers within the Navy that was doing a lot of this work. But because it was viewed as experimental, it wasn't thought of as particularly practical at that time. So it was kind of like they were left to do their own thing, and no one was really thinking it would ever come to anything.
But that's amazing, because it seems so clear to us now how useful something like radar is in warfare. Like, you can have real-time updates about the position of enemy vehicles in the moment, you know.
Yeah.
As soon as they're advancing on you, you can see them in long distances.
Well, especially things like aircraft, which
yeah.
would be particularly useful. And in fact, over in the UK, research was going on, you know, in various places. But largely we have to thank Sir Robert Watson Watt, who was actually a descendant, a relative, a distant relative of the famous Watt. Watt did all the steam engines. At any rate, so Sir Robert Watson Watt began to work with radio waves as a means of detecting aircraft, but first had been working in the meteorological office to develop systems to detect lightning strikes, because lightning can give off radio waves. In fact, lightning strikes do give off radio waves. So if you have a detector, then you can start to detect thunderstorms, and that was considered to be very useful. The United Kingdom at the time wasn't really concerned with developing radio detection systems.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was there was a rumor going around that the Germans had developed a death ray using radio waves. And so the UK government came to Watson Watt and said, if that's a thing, we're going to need one of those. Can you make one of those for us? And so he started looking into it, but very quickly he said, you know, this doesn't seem feasible at all. From everything I've learned, that it doesn't make sense. However, maybe we could focus on radio detection instead of radio destruction. And he really began to push for this means of using radio to bounce waves off of objects so that you can detect them remotely. And he got some support, and it was very important in the UK at the time, because we're talking about getting into World War II, and the UK was heavily involved, and obviously the fears of German aircraft coming over and bombing England were warranted. So they wanted to have this.
Yeah, it was really quite a lot.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
The ability to get people out of an area when they saw craft coming was huge.
Absolutely necessary.
Funny side note to this. This is actually sort of related to the myth that carrots give you super eyesight. Did you know this?
No.
I wrote a Brainstuff episode about this.
It's a fascinating little historical blip.
So, yeah, apparently one of the reasons that the British Royal Air Force was pretty successful in repelling Axis air raids against the British was that they had onboard radar. So, like, these planes were equipped with, radar systems that could tell them when enemy aircraft were approaching from a very long distance.
Mm-hmm. But, of course, they didn't want to let on to anything like that. So part of their misinformation campaign.
Yeah, well, I think that's one theory. Other people have different explanations for why they said this.
But okay.
For whatever reason, the British government said, you know, the reason our pilots can see so well is because they eat lots of vegetables rich in vitamin A,
like
carrots.
So
at the same time, of course, they were trying to get people to eat carrots because that was like one of the few foods that was plentiful in England at the time.
And to grow victory gardens, quote unquote victory gardens, that in which carrots were quite easy to grow.
So. Right.
That's interesting. Yeah. Oh, well, you know.
So it turns out it was a lie, you know, the pilots.
Suggesting that they just had super keen eyesight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the same time, vitamin A is very important for maintaining normal, healthy eyesight.
Sure.
So eat your carrots, kids.
Well, meanwhile, going back over to the United States during the same time, the Navy continued to develop radar, and in fact, named it such, creating the first U.S. radar, and it was called the XAF. It was installed on the USS New York battleship in 1939. So obviously the earliest uses of radar were in military applications, and that's not a huge surprise. I mean, it was that was where it was very much useful. But shortly thereafter, once the war ended, we started to see radar get used in lots of different applications, including a lot of commercial ones. So air traffic control, aboard aircraft itself, like you were saying, Joe, except for, you know, commercial aircraft, not just military aircraft. Also, commercial ships, and other means as well.
And of course, going back to what Watson Watt was originally studying, we began using it for weather detection.
Yeah, and forecasting. And this is a, you know, like Doppler radar, you hear it all the time, especially here in Atlanta. They're so proud of their Doppler radar. But yeah, it's Doppler radar is using the Doppler shift to detect moving weather patterns. And honestly, what they're mostly looking at is precipitation. So, you know, the radar, the radio waves or microwaves will bounce back from precipitation telling you, oh, well, there's a front moving in and we can keep track of it. We can even map out the shape of it. And so when you see the radar imagery, that's based off the data that's coming back from the signals, which is pretty cool. The radar transmitters for Doppler radar for weather are pretty powerful. They use 450,000 watts of electricity when they're blasting out signals.
I gotta be honest, I have no idea how much that is.
A regular microwave oven is 1,000 watts. So
okay,
multiply a regular microwave oven 450 times and you get what... But however, this particular radar technology isn't used, you know, it's not like they turn it on and it's blasting out radio waves for like hours at a time.
Right. It's more like defrost mode on your microwave where it sends out kind of little blips and then collects them all.
Right. It's
to get a composite.
It's spending most of its time listening rather than blasting. So it'll send out a blast of radio waves in a very short amount of time, a fraction of a second. And then it listens for a good long while for the echoes to come back. So we're talking about such a short amount of time that the source I read said it transmits for about 7 seconds in a typical hour.
So it sounds like if they just leave this thing on, the Army could have the death ray they wanted.
Well, they could at least drain the power grid, yeah. If nothing else. I don't know that it would necessarily do anything else besides, it could probably jam communications with that many radio waves going out, but
yeah,
that'd be about it.
Well, I mean, we used to think about radar as this kind of like high tech, expensive military technology.
And it used to be that.
Yeah. But now you see it all over the place, right?
Yeah. Now it's actually making its way into consumer technology. So, you know, it's not going to be in your smartphone, but it might be in your car.
Yet.
Yeah.
So, autonomous cars obviously need to have a lot of sensors, right? In order to note what is in their particular neighborhood so that they know, you know, whether they can merge over or change lanes, speed up, slow down, that kind of thing.
Right. And you can use different kinds of waves to do
this.
For example, one thing we've seen employed a lot in autonomous cars is LIDAR.
Yeah. Which is, it's laser oriented.
Yeah.
As opposed to using radio frequencies. But radar is also used. There are lots of different systems where radar is used to maintain safe distance between the vehicle itself and any vehicles around it.
Yeah.
So, you know, like the rule of thumb being that if you're behind a vehicle, you should be able to count to three when it passes a landmark before you pass that landmark too. Well, these kind of systems will make sure you maintain that safe distance at whatever operating speed the vehicle happens to be at.
Cool. So, yeah. I think you go into a little bit more detail about that one in the video version of our radar episode, right?
Yeah, I specifically talk about dynamic cruise control, which is something that's kind of it's like a stepping stone between the cars we have now and truly autonomous cars. And a lot of vehicles right now have dynamic cruise control. And the basic principle is that you set the cruising speed of your vehicle, but it also has this radar system so it can maintain the proper distance between any cars in front of it. And if it starts to get past a certain threshold of safety, the system will automatically apply the brakes to slow down your vehicle, but you'll still be in cruise control. So you don't have to
manually. Yeah.
You don't have to hit a brake or an accelerator to turn it off. You can just let it keep going. And, you know, if traffic starts picking up, then obviously you would take it off of cruise control. But otherwise, you just let it go.
I think this is an interesting application of radar because if you look back at the history of it, what it was originally great for was seeing stuff that's very far away.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like extending our vision beyond where we could naturally ever hope to sense with our puny little human senses. But now it's more about having cheap, controllable, short-range options.
Oh, sure, especially in that consumer space,
yeah.
Right? Seeing any kind of technology mature, we tend to see this kind of approach, this kind of a pathway. You know, some technologies probably won't ever follow that pathway just because either they'll never get inexpensive enough or there's not a practical consumer application for them. But this is one case where there is a practical application. So that's pretty cool. But there are other practical applications that are go a little beyond being in your vehicle.
Yeah, less on the consumer end. Other cool stuff is happening in radar. For example, radar in space. Sorry,
Link
that was way
throb.
Too much fun. Okay. So starting back around 1994, NASA and the ESA had teamed up and began launching synthetic aperture radar devices into orbit.
Are we sure this isn't from Portal?
No. Synthetic aperture. Yeah, they're like synthetic aperture telescopes. It's a thing.
Yeah, it's totally a thing. It's a really cool thing. Synthetic aperture means that the radar equipment is on a moving vehicle, which to simplify the science ridiculously, like almost criminally, means that the aperture of the antenna can be as long as the vehicle's flight path. And let me explain that a little bit because it makes absolutely no sense the way I just said it. Okay. Picture a dish antenna, right? Its aperture is its diameter. Mm-hmm. Okay. The greater the size of the dish, and thus the greater the size of the aperture, the more data the dish can take in. Thus, the finer the resolution of the final image that it creates. It's similar to how film cameras work. You know, like if you've got a wider lens aperture, more light can come in and you can take a higher resolution photograph.
Yeah, this is one reason we can't, say, resolve images of things that are really, really, really far away. We just can't build telescopes with an aperture wide enough.
Mm. Oh, right.
If you could imagine like an, you know, infinitely large aperture, you could technically probably resolve almost anything out there.
Like the end of the universe.
Yeah.
But this is totally like the, yes, now zoom in. No, it doesn't always work like that.
Zoom and enhance.
Zoom and enhance. Yeah. Well, you can usually zoom in, but.
And it seems like it'd be impossible to build something that had a physical aperture that big.
Right. And, you know, if you put an antenna on a vehicle like an airplane or a satellite, it means that you're limiting the physical size of the antenna to what that craft can carry.
Mm-hmm.
But by putting the vehicle in motion and including a whole lot of processing capacity, the flight of the vehicle can act like the total aperture of the antenna.
Wow.
So kind of crazy. Yeah.
So it's like a virtual. Now I got the virtual aperture.
Yeah.
Okay. It's like exactly what you called it earlier on.
Synthetic aperture.
Synthetic.
That's true. You said synthetic.
Yeah. And this is really cool physically. Just in terms of the pure science of it, but it's also awesomely practical. For example, it's used currently to monitor situations like wear to natural environments and damage done in disasters and illegal logging and stuff like that. And researchers are also looking at ways to bend it to even more different kinds of work, like structural monitoring of infrastructure.
Hmm.
The tech can detect movements of mere millimeters, so it can look for problems in places that no human person might go out to for, you know, however long it takes to send someone out there.
Yeah, I've actually seen this used in mapping features as well, in order to do topographical mapping, that kind of thing. And in fact, the image I saw was of Florida, and it was amazing the amount of resolution there. Another really cool thing that we're seeing, and it involves a space agency, but not a space application, NASA and the Department of Homeland Security partnered in an initiative called Finding Individuals for Disaster and Emergency Response, or FINDER. And it's a low-powered microwave radar that looks – it's used by rescue workers who are looking for survivors in the wake of a disaster. And recently it was used in the wake of the massive earthquake in Nepal. So obviously that was a huge tragedy. And a lot of people went to try and help. And one of the groups had this low-power microwave radar. And it can actually detect survivors by detecting their heartbeats. They're using radar to detect heartbeats through rubble, like up to 30 feet of rubble or 20 feet of concrete or 100 feet of open space. And the fluctuations of the heartbeat or the fluctuations of your chest just from breathing are enough for the radar to pick up the differences in that Doppler shift and tell the rescuers there's somebody down there, which is pretty phenomenal. So, you know, we've covered radar looking at weather. We looked at radar looking at massive areas of the Earth and also just radar looking for a single person in rubble, which is pretty amazing to me.
But so these are all current applications of radar. Mm-hmm. What about the future?
Oh, I got it. Radar home cooking appliances, like a radar panini press, radar. No, okay, never mind. Lauren, what's the future of radar?
Well, Joe, sorry to tell you, there are no panini presses that I am personally aware of in the works using radar, but modular radar is a thing that a few research and development firms are working on. See, right now, radar systems mostly have to be custom designed for any given application. Now, I will say a key feature of modern military radar, at any rate, is the use of arrays of transmitters, which allow the capacity to broadcast multiple beams that work in tandem to cover a greater range and also help escape signal detection by other parties, which is pretty cool. So, you know, if you're talking about extra bits that you add to radar, you could say that an array is sort of modular in a way, but that's not what I'm talking about.
So you mean just modular by, like, adding parts, like lots of little bits that you add together?
Well, see, there are also definitely systems for building your own necessary power and type of radar using interchangeable parts on a base kind of unit. But as far as I can tell, it wasn't until the 2000s that patents began appearing for something closer to like plug-and-play modular radar, wherein each unit is the same and can interact with other units to adapt to particular tasks.
So instead of having to commission a new customized radar system for whatever application you have in mind, you could go back to this basic modular approach and build it from that, which I would imagine dramatically decreases the cost.
Yeah. You can just order rather than having to order an entire system or even an entire system that you can kind of customize. You can just order a certain number of these units and they'll wind up working together. The Navy, via a contract with Raytheon, has been developing the scalable radar system. That the building blocks of these systems are called radar modular assemblies, and each unit is a 2-foot square block that contains everything it needs to function alone. But when grouped together, their power is multiplicative, which is so cool. This is meant to replace the SPY-1 radar, which is currently in use on naval ships, which supports air defense and weather data collection and ballistic missile defense and can help counter other forces' search and track capacity. So good stuff all. But 9 of these modular suckers could replace the SPY-1, which is about twice as large as this array of modular things would be, being a 12-foot octagon.
What, the SPY-1 is?
The SPY-1 is a 12-foot octagon.
Is the octagon.
It is an octagon, yeah. Yes, because apparently we are living in Battlestar Galactica.
Either that or the UFC.
You know, Raytheon really sounds like it should be the name of a house in Game of Thrones.
I was totally trying to figure out how to do that joke. Thank you.
But I can't argue with that.
But so that's 9 of these modular units. If you go up to 37 units, Raytheon says that you could find a target half the size at twice the range of a SPY-1.
Wow.
And if you've got 69 of these units, you could find a target half the size at nearly 4 times the range. Or, you know, if you wanted to, you could just stick a single unit on a smaller vehicle. The system is set for release in 2016, and as of, like, today, which is May 12th, 2015, Raytheon says that the system has passed an internal and naval critical design review. So it's moving forward, y'all.
Wow.
Radar is coming.
I want to hum the theme song so badly right now.
Tell us more, Lauren.
I shall. Yeah. I shall. Northrop Grumman, who was also in competition for the Navy's contract on these modular units, seems to be working on a vaguely similar system for the Air Force. And hey, you know, this sort of thing would be also great for smaller, perhaps commercial applications, like running security on campuses and on streets and in shipyards, especially using frequencies that can penetrate precipitation and stuff like that.
Huh.
So all of this is thanks, you know, to technological advances in both receiver and transmitter technology, but also to lots of other tech that we've talked about on the show before, like modular robotic research and semiconductor research and software and algorithmic improvements. So it's just fascinating seeing all of these industries coming together to create these relatively easy to use products that can be used in so many ways.
Yeah, I think that's I had no idea about this. And this is interesting. It's another application of the sort of like modular principle, like we talked about in the modular robotics episode. Mm-hmm. I like this idea of lots of little minions that come together to become something greater.
Okay, well, you know, some of the other stuff that we need to talk about are some of the challenges that come along with radar. Mm-hmm. And one of the big ones is that, you know, you've got a transmitter and a receiver. Your receiver is essentially a giant antenna that's trying to pick up very faint signals.
Sure, but the more sensitive your receiver is, obviously the more junk it's going to pick up.
And that's a real issue, right? How do you tell the stuff you want from all the junk that you're getting as well? Mm-hmm. So in other words, like you're trying to find out whether or not, you know, a stealth vehicle is flying overhead, but all you're picking up is the Zoo Cruise radio show, you know, that's 3 miles down the road. That's obviously for the sake of levity, but really, I mean, there is this problem of how do you separate the signal from the noise? And, you know, depending upon the application you're using, it may not be that big of a deal. It may be pretty simple, but the more refined you get, the more difficult it becomes to make the separation. So let's say that you're using a microwave radar system and you want to have a very high resolution of the data that you're getting back. That's actually pretty challenging. And there is a team of researchers in Italy who have been trying to make it easier using a photonics system. Now, photonics, if you break down the word, you know that obviously it has to do with light. It's some sort of optical system. They're actually using lasers and photonic diodes in order to generate radio frequencies. And the reason they're doing it is because if you're using a traditional radar system, you typically begin with an analog signal. Then you have to convert that analog signal into a digital signal. So use a converter to convert it to digital. And then you want to blast that out as your means of trying to detect stuff. But you also want to use a very high frequency if you can, because that's where you're going to get the higher resolution data back. But this approach is usually limited to around 2 gigahertz in frequency. If you want to go beyond that, you have to put that signal through what's called an up converter. It's essentially boosting the signal.
Which we can totally do.
Yeah, we can do that. And you can boost the signal and send it out. And when it comes back, now you got to read it. And you can't read it in that up converted format. You actually have to run it through down conversion so that you can read this signal. And the problem is every single step in that process, from changing the analog to digital to up conversion to down conversion, can introduce more noise, meaning that whatever you're getting back is getting harder and harder to actually analyze. So the photonics system gets around that by using this optics system to generate those radio frequencies. And the researchers say they can do a much broader range of frequencies, including much higher frequencies than any other system can make at the moment, and do it in a much more stable way that it doesn't have this problem of introducing noise, and they don't have to down convert the returning echoing signal in order to analyze it, because they're using the same system to generate and receive the messages. They've even said that you could switch this to a communications system if you needed to. So not only would it become a transmitter and receiver for radar, but it could become a communications device where you could communicate with other stations. So pretty cool. They call it FODIR, FODIR. And they built a prototype device, and it worked. So they're now working on turning it into more of a practical tool, because there's a big difference between a prototype and something that would actually work for anybody.
Of course, yeah.
But pretty exciting.
Yeah, just everything today sounds like a Game of Thrones character. I've clearly been watching Hodor. Yeah, okay.
All right.
So what are some other problems that we need to solve in radar technology?
Well, a similar one to what we just mentioned is that the returning echoes can be very, very faint, particularly if we're looking at something that does not want to be found, like a stealth plane. So, you know, stealth planes, the reason why they're stealth is not, you know, it's not that they're hard to see. They're usually pretty easy to see when they're on the ground. It's that they're hard to detect, right?
Right.
Their surfaces are designed so that they disperse incoming radio waves so that they don't reflect back to the point of origin. So it makes it much harder to detect with a radar station. So now people are saying, well, how can we detect it? You know, some of the radio waves do get reflected back, but they're usually so faint, there's so few of them, that it is hard to say that's an actual hit versus a false positive, you know, or noise, random noise. So some researchers at the University of York came up with a clever way of improving the sensitivity of radar receivers using our old buddy quantum physics.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
Joe, I sense you have some uncertainty about quantum physics.
Oh.
Okay, that was your third pun for the episode.
It was also
I'm
the second time I've referred to that joke, because I did that in the video episode, too. But anyway, although I don't know if they may have cut that. The video episode hasn't gone live yet. So at any rate, so the way that they're using quantum physics is through entanglement, quantum entanglement. And we've talked about that on this show before.
Sure.
But generally speaking, this gets pretty complicated. We're going to use the super simplified way of saying it. Quantum entanglement involves coupling two particles or waves in such a way that their states complement each other. So if we think of it in photons, we usually talk about – or electrons. Let's talk about electrons. You know, usually talk about electron spin. So if one electron is spinning up, the other electron is spinning down. And they are coupled this way no matter how far apart you may move the two particles, as long as you don't make the system – collapse on itself.
Right.
In which case the entanglement ends and they no longer are
coupled. About their mutual business.
Yeah, they have nothing to do with each other.
Yeah. So another way of putting it is that if you know something about one of these particles, you know something about the other one.
Right. At that moment, at any rate. Yes.
Yeah.
So in this case, they are coupling a microwave beam with an optical beam. And the way this works is the optical beam is more or less contained within the radar system itself. There is some detection that goes with that, but it gets way too complicated for me to understand, let alone describe. So to simplify it, the optical beam is contained within the system. The microwave beam is used to beam out at wherever direction you're looking at. When returning microwaves come back in, you can compare those echoes against the optical beam. So the optical beam acts like a reference. And because the two are entangled, there's going to be certain points where they correlate if, in fact, that is the same microwave beam you beamed out in the first place. And that would tell you, yes, there is, in fact, something there, because these are the same beams you sent out in the first place. And you could be sure of that because the odds of these two different beams matching up randomly are so astronomical as to be unthinkable.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, if you send it out and you get a very faint reading, you might say, ah, I think there's a stealth vehicle flying toward us based upon this reading. And the only reason we can be sure is because the qualities of this microwave beam reflect the qualities of the optical beam that are already in the system because they were coupled together earlier. Which is pretty amazing stuff. It blew my mind when I read into it because, you know, I didn't even think about the possibility of entangling two very different things, an optical beam and a – well, I mean, obviously, they're both electromagnetic radiation,
but
you don't really associate them together, right? I mean, the only time I associate microwaves and light are when I open up the microwave door and the little light comes on. Otherwise, it doesn't happen.
It's a different kind of entanglement.
Yeah, I have often been entangled with microwaves, but that's more of a cord issue.
Yikes.
Yeah. At any rate, I thought it was really cool to see kind of this emerging technological development and, you know, even this system of radar, which you wouldn't really necessarily think has evolved that much since it was first, designed and engineered. you would figure, oh, well, that's a very basic principle. I could see where we could get better and better at detecting it, but how do we go beyond that? It's pretty amazing, I think. And whenever you get to the point where you're incorporating quantum mechanics, it really gets pretty, heavy in my book.
Yeah.
Yeah. So at any rate, this was really fun to talk about. It was an interesting kind of thing that we hadn't really considered before. But if you guys out there in listener land have suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, keep sending those emails. We're accumulating them. We're addressing them. We're doing more and more listener-oriented episodes, and we love hearing from you guys. Maybe you have a question. Maybe you have a suggestion. I'd love to, or maybe even you've worked with Radar and you want to tell us about your experiences. We'd love to hear from you. The email address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. Or you can drop us a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Google Plus. At Twitter and Google Plus, we are FW Thinking. At Facebook, just search FW Thinking in the search bar. Our Facebook page will pop up. Come like us, please. And leave us a message, and we'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.